We are very lucky to get an opportunity to have some funding to run an incubation program through Welfare Matters. It would take quite a bit of time for us to nail down the specifics. Our general proposal when we put in the funding application was to seed a few projects in this region, specifically for farm animal welfare interventions. We have this general idea of trying to look at charity entrepreneurship's model, and also trying to look at what are some of the specific interventions in this region that might be able to find entrepreneurial types of people to apply and join the incubation program.
Hi, my name is Amy.
And my name is James.
And this is How I Learned to Love Shrimp, a podcast about promising ways to help animals and build the animal advocacy movement.
If it wasn't obvious from the previous conversations, Amy and I think Asia is an extremely important place for farmed animal advocacy. To put it in context, Asia currently accounts for around 45% of vertebrate land animals killed for food each year and around 89% of farmed fish. Thankfully, in this episode, we speak with Wanyi Zeng, who is the Executive Director of Welfare Matters, who is working hard on building the farmed animal movement in Southeast Asia. We speak about the findings of Welfare Matters' very detailed and insightful report into the animal agriculture landscape in six key Southeast Asian countries. We speak about the challenges facing the movement in Asia, as well as Welfare Matters' very exciting plans to incubate new projects in the region. Additionally, a very small, shameful plug is we would really appreciate it if you could rate us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps people find us. If you feel inclined to give us a five-star rating on every platform or write a written review, that would be particularly great, but no pressure. Without further ado, here is the conversation with Wanyi. Today, we are joined by Wanyi Zeng, who is the Executive Director of Welfare Matters, which is an organization that is focused on building capacity for the farmed animal advocacy movement in Southeast Asia. Welcome, Wanyi.
Hi, James and Amy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. So as we start everyone off, what's an animal-related view you've changed your mind on recently and why?
I think recently it'll be something movement related after I came back from the recent AVA conference in LA. The movement related view that I've updated on is on the funding landscape globally for farmed animals advocacy movement. I think previously I thought that that we are actually quite well funded as a movement. I somehow had the impression we have quite a lot of funding. Because based out of Southeast Asia, I've heard since 2 years ago that people are looking into where can they fund in Southeast Asia. There is funding, there aren't projects. So I just built on that impression. But at AVA, I started to hear about the global landscape of funding. I'm quite surprised by how many groups feel the strain. That's something I'm keeping in mind that and updating since AVA.
Mm. I think that's really interesting. It's probably been like a slightly challenging trajectory because I think if you looked maybe 10, 15 years ago when some of the bigger organizations were founded, you know, the likes of THL, it was very like grassroots volunteer base, mm-hmm. not a lot of money. And then perhaps over that time, it's increased to, as you say, like a really large amount, you know, multi-millions being given to this cause, specifically in places like the US and probably Europe. And then I think maybe over the last couple of years, it started to decline again. So perhaps it's just this moment in time where in a short space of time, it's felt like we have loads. And now it feels like there's definitely less and there's maybe more competition, more groups, the funding's having to be more widely dispersed. I definitely feel like that's felt across the movement, isn't it? That there's just this kind of, not as kind of affluent as we were a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And I think for context, so I think, the movement, the animal movement kind of raises about $200 to $300 million a year, which sounds like quite a lot. Then you put it in the context of the climate movement, which is, I think, between $5 and $10 billion. So we're anywhere between like 20 to 40 times smaller in funding, which it's like, wow, we're really a small fry. And, you know, the climate movement only gets 2% of global philanthropy. So again, we're like maybe 200, whatever, however many times smaller than like the philanthropic world. So I think, yeah, in the big scheme of things, we definitely aren't very significant yet, but we'll see what happens.
Nice. So that was really interesting, Wanyi. Yeah, thank you for starting us off with that. So I also was recently at the Asia Farmed Animal Day conference with you and was really inspired by your closing talk to the conference, which felt like a really prominent moment. And you were talking through your journey to this point. And I wondered if you could just give us some kind of highlights of that journey today.
Sure. It could be a little bit of a long story, but I'll try to keep it brief. Because cool. I have to say, I didn't think of ever doing my career for farmed animals or even animals. I've been a very trying to make a dent on global health angle. And that's my draw into effective altruism, which led me onto this path to work on farmed animals currently. Back then, I read Peter Singer's book, which it's not Animal Liberation. It's actually The Life You Can Save. And there wasn't any movement back then until 2013, 2014. Peter Singer gave a TED Talk. And then I started to know people in person who talked about, hey, have you heard about effective altruism? And there weren't any chapters in Asia. I think there could have been one in Hong Kong around the same time that ES Singapore started. And it was a lot of nudging from people that ES Singapore started. Again, we didn't want to do any specific causes. We wanted to build a community of people who are interested to do more good, because Singapore has so much excess wealth. And looking around, we know that there are people who are seeking more meaning than the day-to-day jobs. So it felt quite promising to have an EA chapter here. But it was definitely a different time to do EA chapter as compared to now, because a lot more things are centralized now. Funding landscape has changed. People are more coordinated. Back then, we just took anything that we found on the internet and tried to make it as accurate as possible to share here. Fast forward a few years to the last 2 years, we, again, through EA, we were nudged by some folks to do a farmed animal welfare fellowship for the region. I was a little resistant because Singapore is not an agricultural country. It didn't seem that we would be the best chapter to do farmed animal advocacy related work. But then we started to look at the numbers, and Divya had joined me in the team by then. So I was completely surprised by how high the production of land animals, we're just looking at land animals, is from Southeast Asia. Top five in the world, subcontinental region-wise. And then we looked at which organizations operate here. I was very surprised that there were less than five organizations that were working full time entirely on this issue. I think I was surprised because we ran YAGX Singapore conferences, and we had a lot of animal speakers, and so it was which I just didn't realize that there aren't that many groups.
And so that less than five was across Southeast Asia at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Full time. We started to see some groups that they might be a shelter organization, and they had like a small program that's starting out for farmed animals. So when we counted five, right, it was entirely focused on farmed animal advocacy. So that really changed our minds, and we thought, okay, that's a space that we can fill. And we were very lucky to get funding, which also was a very big factor for us being able to dedicate our focus. So we designed the fellowship program targeted at Southeast Asia's context as much as possible. Not very easy, because we still import a lot of information from the West. So we just got rolling from there. The interest has been consistent. We've been very lucky with things being quite smooth. And Then came the time to rebrand from Yes Singapore to Welfare Matters to better reflect that focus. It just wasn't very easy to do EA Singapore community building anymore. It was also probably time since it's been a long time since I got involved.
Yeah, sure.
So you've been involved in EA Singapore since 2013 or 2014, is that right? So
2015, 2016. That was a lot of nudging from one friend to start the chapter.
Good. Thanks, nice. Friend.
Yeah, it's awesome. And then, so with Welfare Matters, what was like the final push or the nudge that made you want to really focus your time on Welfare Matters rather than EA Singapore?
To be frank, I think I struggled a lot with EA Singapore at some point. I don't know if it's too frank, but it is. It is a struggle because, as I said, I started EA Singapore from a very early phase, a very different landscape. And I think I struggled to keep up with the evolving landscape. And also EA Singapore, we wanted to keep things more broad-based. It was very hard to measure how much money have we influenced being moved to more effective cause areas and charities, how many people have done career changes. It was, for quite a long time, we've been unable to really pin down, even though we can see the effect of a growing community by, let's say, how many people are on the community chat groups or by the number of people who show up at year conferences. So counterfactually, it was pretty hard to measure the impact. And I think it's also gotten to a point where there are newer organizers who can better step up to organizing. And it made more sense that we focus on trying to continue our contribution to the founder advocacy movement in this region. So yeah, the change.
That's great. I look forward to talking more about Welfare Matters in later on in the episode and hearing more about that fellowship. Mm-hmm. But perhaps for now, let's explore the challenges and additional challenges to what you've already referred to that you identify when working in this region, specifically on this topic. I've definitely echo your thoughts on the vast movement of growth in this region of the movement over the last few years. I remember attending the Asia for Animals conference in China, in Dalian, in 2019, wow. Just before the pandemic. And there was a small panel, side panel on farmed animal welfare. Four speakers, I was one of them, someone from Anima, Andreas from Anima, Leah Edgerton, who was head of ACE at the time, and Jeff from Compassion World Farming, China. So it felt like this really prominent panel. And there was probably about 20 people in the talk. And it was just so interesting out of the, you know, hundreds that were in attendance, how little kind of exposure there was to farmed animal work at the time. Fast forwarding to last week, where we were both in attendance at the Asia Farmed Animal Day conference with over, you know, 250 people all there just to work on this farmed animal issue. So it's definitely been that kind of period of growth. Before we kind of got to that level, what have been some of the biggest challenges that you've identified across the region on working on this topic specifically?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge, I suppose all of us would agree, is just the sheer number of animals that exist. And just, I've become less idealistic as I get older. So I'm not thinking that Welfare Matters is going to, like, make a dent and get the farmed animals to zero. In 30 years. If I started out, I probably...
40 years, though.
40 years. yeah. Any number of, like, less than 50 years would be great. But not so idealistic now. So it makes things a little bit more... I'm trying to work in a way that's more pragmatic. So the sheer numbers, I think, is not something that we want to keep in mind the entire time, but focus more on program level things that we can have an effect on. I think getting the challenge here is we don't really know about the intensive farming situation in Southeast Asia. It's very interesting because we thought that the ways that animals are raised would be the same. The climate is different over here. And the way that we don't seem to have a lot of evidence of what's happening on the ground in a very generalizable way. And so that's a challenge in then what interventions should be prioritized in Southeast Asia. That's one right. aspect, what things would be highest impact that can affect farmed animals' welfare the most in this region. The other aspect, which is where Welfare Matters is trying to work on more, people actually working on this issue. Yeah, so trying to get the people who are interested in helping farmed animals, being involved in the movement and in a dedicated way, professional if possible. That's something that we are working on. But we would also be stuck with then what next? Because the ecosystem isn't really there in Southeast Asia for this issue. So these are just a couple of challenges that we currently are facing. But I think we are getting a lot of support from other organizations whenever we need more brains to pick on. And we're getting a lot of support from the global movement. So yeah, there's still some hope over here.
Nice. So if I've got that right, it seems like the first problem is there's like a general lack of knowledge on how most animals are farmed in countries in Southeast Asia. And as a result, it's hard to prioritize interventions because, you know, what's the point of doing a corporate campaign if most of targets aren't in like, let's say, big corporate environments? And then the other problem is, even when you do identify interventions, then there's not necessarily like a wide range of groups who are ready and willing to like take up new campaigns. And actually, it's hard to find people who are willing, or maybe you have to start new groups and it's not clear how to do that. Is that kind of right in terms of those two challenges?
Yeah, the latter would be not just finding people and groups, whether it's interest level, capacity level, but also ecosystem wise. How do we go about coordinating? How do we go about making sure that everything has a good plan?
And you talked about the sheer number of animals. Do you have any kind of off the top of your head stats comparatively to other parts of the world about the raising of farmed animals in this region, or even consumption levels and how they differ from maybe the US and Europe?
Yeah, off the top of my mind, I can only say that in Southeast Asia, when we were looking at the FAO stats, we are comparable in terms of farmed land animals to South America and Northern America. In terms of, we're just moving around like the second, third, or fourth place for the number of farmed animals. The largest subcontinental region with the most farmed animals would be Eastern Asia. I suppose that's probably a contribution a lot from China's side. And then I think we are just a little bit more than Southern Asia. So that's like where India is with other South Asian countries. So we've started looking at the stats from 2019 till now. We don't seem to be moving too far away. Yeah, so that's like number of farmed animals. Consumption-wise, I don't really have good numbers to share.
And then to clarify, so by Southeast Asia, you probably mean like six countries, right? So it's Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, Philippines, Singapore, Indonesia.
Southeast Asia has around 11 countries. But Welfare Matters, we had to scope something to be able to focus a little bit more than six countries, just feel like a lot. The 11 countries here, these actually five of the ones that you mentioned are where most animal agriculture happens. But we inserted Singapore partly because we're based here. I'm not sure if it's very rational, but we do have a huge impact in terms of consumption. We import a ton of food from the region, including live animals. And we also have the odd protein that's seen here that is pretty interesting, although Welfare Matters doesn't focus on it. But we've kept Singapore, although this is not really a country that we think we would do much of advocacy related stuff.
The cultivated meat work is so interesting. Do you feel like that's been kind of always brewing in Singapore as one of these, as you say, like countries that just has such a lot of money and kind of infrastructure to support these types of inventions, I want to say. Is that, do you think that has been something that you've been aware of kind of brewing since your involvement in the EA space in Singapore, or has that come about kind of surprisingly?
No, I've known of GFI's presence in this region sometime in 2018, 2019. And I think that just some conversations with people, the earliest person working at GFI APAC, she had been based in Hong Kong and coming to Singapore a lot. And I also knew the folks at GFI India. So Singapore is not surprising in terms of a place where cultivated meats support, because we are so reliant on other countries for food sources. Singapore has set a goal called the 30 by 30 policy. By 2030, the country would like to have 30% of food being produced in Singapore. Which it means that we need to be using any possible means, including like vertical farming for vegetables and cultivated meat. So I don't think like advocacy folks should think that, well, Singapore is great with farming and welfare. Actually, it's just out of pragmatism that this happens. I don't think it's got to do with welfare related concerns per se.
It's national security, isn't it? Fundamentally, it's like you're worried about being dependent on other countries for your food, and that's like a huge geosecurity problem.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's sadly not very altruistic, but yeah. still good for us. I mean, I'll take it.
Yeah. It's like no confrontation needed. Like, just like, oh, great. Like, that's the good way to produce our food. I think sometimes in Asia, I think that from Singapore's point of view, just being pragmatic can get us to finding solutions pretty fast without needing to to argue a lot on some issues, value laden issues. And I think economic wise, Singapore is definitely an anomaly in Southeast Asia in terms of how we're performing economically. So it does mean that high-tech innovations and GFI has done a great job engaging with universities and the government to be able to also enable these to come about. So yeah, it's something to watch for in the next few years.
And that's the Good Food Institute, right?
Yes, that's the Good Food Institute. And then there's the Asia Pacific Good Food Institute that is based out of Singapore.
Has that led or kind of driven public opinion on the topic? Maybe specifically in Singapore, it's interesting, James, that you were saying like it's kind of less altruistic. So perhaps people are more interested in cultivated meat just from an economic perspective, or like you say, like a sort of space saving and more sustainable way for Singapore to create food. Is the public opinion therefore also different in that maybe the motivation for moving away from farmed animal based produce into cultivated meat is influenced by other factors comparatively to the region as the rest of the region as well?
I wouldn't say Singapore is less altruistic. In fact, there have been government efforts to try to mobilize the nation's like altruism through setting up lots of campaigns and programs to get people to give more internally, locally more than internationally, and also volunteering. So there is this promotion. There are even things like kindness movement. It's strange that we need to... in Singapore, because we are a really young country. And so there's a lot of development socially that is not really evolving at the same pace as the way people are economically empowered. As compared to the region, I think we can take a sign from the veganism movement here. We can see that a lot more demand is happening. I'm not actually sure what the motivation is. I think definitely farmed animals would be something that people care about, but we are also having huge consumptions for meat. It's hard to pinpoint whether this is something that is getting people motivated to care more about farmed animals. I would say farmed animal welfare is very absent in the public domain as an issue, whether it's in Southeast Asia or Singapore. I think that that's just so much work to do for just putting it into people's consciousness that farm animals are actually sentient beings. So veganism has been happening, and you can see from where we can get food that are plant-based. A lot of restaurants, most restaurants have at least one or two plant-based options. So so that's actually much more accessible than, say, 10 years ago when I started to not eat meat. I find that maybe because I was late in discovering, but I would say the options are getting a lot more available here.
Maybe to go back to one of the challenges you spoke about early on, which is like the lack of, I guess, good information on kind of like the state of animal farming in Southeast Asia. I'm kind of curious to ask you about, so you put out you being Welfare Matters, put out a very extensive report, I think over 140 pages, which I'll be the first to admit, I have not read it fully. but there is a webinar that I'm planning on watching. And there's lots of interesting findings in there. Particularly one that stood out for me is actually that ducks were the second most farmed animal in Southeast Asia, and which was around 247 million raised and killed, which was totally new to me because I didn't know that ducks were kind of raised and killed in those amounts. So that was really interesting knowledge. But I guess I'd be curious to hear from you what else from this research project stuck out to you as like something you weren't aware of or something new that was something that might be able to inform people's thinking on the region strategy.
Yeah, we don't expect people to read page to page, 140 pages. But I think it just got a little bigger than we actually wanted to scope it.
We will link it, by the way. We'll link it below so people can actually have a look. And also, I think there's a recorded webinar, so we'll link that as well, if that's okay.
That'd be good. I also want to first give credit to Lateris, who did all the painstaking literature review. This topic is pretty new to him, so kudos to him for also accessing things in non-English language. He has to be creative in figuring out how to figure out what the report in Bahasa Indonesia is and like in Thai is. So yeah. On the ducks part, we were definitely surprised because since getting involved in the movement more fully, I wouldn't count those days I was doing ES Singapore as really being involved in a farmed animal advocacy movement. So in the last few years, I've not heard anything about ducks. And so it was a surprise to us that there's so many ducks, like you say, James. But I also want to highlight that chickens actually still represent 96% of all animals being farmed in this region, just land animals. So even though ducks are higher than pigs, it's still dwarfs in terms of comparison to chickens. Some of the interesting findings are, I would say, the trade aspects of the report that we found. The movement of animals that is happening in this region, we were surprised that some countries actually are big importers, like Vietnam and Indonesia, by USD value. We thought that these are agricultural countries, they were pretty much self-sufficient, but they do actually import quite a lot. From where specifically, it's hard to pinpoint, but live animal trade, Malaysia would be very interesting to note that they do export quite a lot of live animals, most likely to Singapore. Also like Thailand, all of Thailand's exports for animal products, it's like four times the rest of the five countries added together. So Thailand is really huge. Some of these numbers are what we were interested in finding is understanding where animals are farmed, what are the conditions they're farmed in, and what would be the leverage. If live transport is happening so much in a particular country, should we look at the live transportation's welfare, if it's even possible? If animals are slaughtered in particular countries, do we want to know what's the slaughter conditions in those countries? We're not sure how to interpret all this information yet, but we have found it really interesting. I think one other thing I find worthwhile pointing out is on what we consider small-scale and large-scale chicken farms, broiler chicken farms in this region. What's considered a large farm in Indonesia is actually considered a small-scale farm in Thailand. And what's considered a large farm in Malaysia could be a medium-scale farm in Thailand. So the implication of that is, again, how do we make sense of the agricultural farming landscape in Southeast Asia? If we don't compare, you know, this is the size of a large farm, it's the same as a large farm in another country. What kinds does this particular advocacy for welfare standards also apply to another? So it's a huge challenge trying to even figure out the landscape here.
It's so great to have this report to go off. I feel like whenever an organization hits a kind of barrier like this where you just don't have the data and then you decide to just produce something for yourself, so you at least know you're starting from some grounding of having done your own explicit research to try and just understand the landscape, I think is always really powerful. And I'm sure that other organizations in Southeast Asia are getting a lot from the report to try and even compare their advocacy, like you're saying. Maybe they, you know, think they're making like really great progress in one region, whereas actually, you know, if those efforts are focused somewhere else or the same kind of strategies are supporting the movement elsewhere, we could have a lot more impact. So I guess this is where also you can kind of weave in those effective altruism principles of trying to do the most that we can and not just focusing on our individual country just because that happens to be where we're based, actually like the broad region and what is the big impact we can have there.
We definitely were very low in our confidence in putting it out. Amy, you would know because you helped us a little bit with the design, but we delayed it so much because we felt like, oh, is this like not enough information? Our primary thing that we wanted to get was to beautifully map out, like, okay, like in each country, how many percent of pigs are farmed in this way? And this way means this condition. We didn't get to actually find out those core things, but we've been very appreciative that people have been sharing with us. It's somewhat helpful. And our aim is at Welfare Matters to continue to try to monitor the numbers a little bit more and see if we can build up a picture over time.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like those projects are so difficult when you embark on them to answer questions and find answers, and actually you just produce more questions. But at least they're questions that we now know we need to find the answers to, or how to progress to find those answers. So either way, it's information collecting. It maybe just doesn't feel as kind of like resolute as you were hoping in terms of those stats. But yeah, I imagine immensely helpful.
I have to add on that people have been talking about aquatic landscape. We have been thinking about it, but we're not quite sure if we would be the right people to do that, because the numbers just seem so much harder to find and make sense of. But throwing it out there to anyone who wants to take this on, it'd be great to know what's the aquatic farming landscape in Southeast Asia. Yeah,
I think that's an important point, because I think when I said my thing before, I'd like to be in the second most farmed animal, I meant most farmed land animal, because obviously when you're thinking about aquatic animals, and which your report doesn't focus on, the numbers get much bigger when you think about farmed fish and other invertebrates or shrimp or something. So yeah, I think that's a really good point. And so you just think there's almost not enough information for that to even kind of embark on that in a confident way. Was that your main reservation for also tackling the aquatic animal side?
Mostly Lefteris has been speaking to quite a few folks in the aquatic animal advocacy space. We find that perhaps a lot of organizations are already doing in-house research for what they need for making decisions. That's one consideration. I'm not shutting it entirely, but this is where we are at currently, on trying to figure out what makes sense for us to focus our efforts on. And also because there are so many species of fish, and then when it comes to shrimp, it's very specific welfare needs. So we are not quite sure if we can embark on a research project to fully look into aquatic animals farming landscape in a way that can do it justice. The numbers also just seem really hard to pin down, and what would be the welfare standards to actually refer to. At the start of our landscape report for the land animals one, we used heavily benchmarked with World Organization for Animal Health. So there are some benchmark there, and the ducks came about also because we couldn't find actually any standards for ducks from that terrestrial guide. So we're not pursuing it very strongly now on trying to look into aquatic animal landscape for now. But we would love to have conversations with people who are interested in this topic, landscape of Southeast Asia.
Nice. And another thing I found quite interesting, and I think that there are some really beautiful graphics, actually, I do recommend people looking at. I think particularly on the thing you mentioned, which is about the kind of like the different types of farms in the countries. You mentioned, for example, you know, a small farm in Thailand is very different to a small farm in Vietnam. And I think there's some really interesting kind of graphics to look at. For example, it's like 80% of Thailand has like small farms, but then you look at the small farm limit for Thailand, it seems much higher than other countries. So I think that's like an interesting takeaway for strategy. But do you think, based on like the different consolidation of the industries, do you have any like ideas or first guesses on how that should influence like maybe which countries are easier to target with certain campaigns or strategies and that kind of thing?
No, unfortunately, at our level, we don't have that level of insight. Also, because we don't understand well enough how to do campaigns. That's not where we focus on. We hope that this information gets out to organizations that actually do the work. And also, regarding campaigns, I think something to add on is that while we have grouped the six countries under Southeast Asia, every country has a very different landscape on the possibility of campaigns. I think kudos to folks in some regional countries who go out on the streets to raise awareness of the issues and put pressure. This is something in Singapore we would never, ever do. And so every country's organizations have to figure out, with the information they have, what's the most appropriate way that's suitable to the society and norms to apply for their strategy to try to make change. So at our level, we'll try not to get to the nitty-gritty of what campaign recommendations to do at this stage.
I can maybe speak a little bit to that, James. The conference last week was really interesting because I think this is kind of a really big topic in the movement at the moment, being country-specific in the campaigning. I think for a while we've relied on the tactics that came out of Western advocacy, like the pressure campaigning and, predominantly led by bigger organizations. And now that the advocacy space in Southeast Asia is more prominent, is starting to have more people working on this topic, I think it is really important that we're assessing country by country what the best tactics are in that region. I was talking with Lucas at Mercy for Animals, and they're doing some scoping work in Southeast Asia at the moment to try and answer that exact question for Mercy for Animals and their country offices there. And it's a sense of whether these farms are concentrated or diffused, whether they're kind of centralized or decentralized. The kind of often it's the biggest kind of challenge is when it's wet markets. You know, how do you trace that back to the producers? It's just a completely different scope to places like the UK, where I'm based, where you go to a big corporation, they can trace back to kind of five farms, so you're just asking them to update their welfare in those five farms, job done. Here it's like, okay, there's maybe like the chain is just even impossible to track, never mind target, in terms of that company knowing where their food comes from. Is it across like 1,000 small farms, small holdings, where they then feed into wet markets and then people are buying the produce from there? So I think there's still just so much work to do on a country level, exactly as you said, 1 year. And I think that's the next few years is going to be really important in how we kind of influence the research on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, is there anything else from that report, 1 year, you think you want to share, or anything that was like otherwise interesting or surprising for you that people might be curious about?
I think that just many things. We didn't go into corporate commitment so much in the report because we felt that the movement knows quite a lot of information about that. I would say, I'm not sure if it's something that we should pay a lot of attention to, but zoonotic disease outbreak happens enough to actually, it should be more noticed in this region. But I have to say, when we looked into zoonotic diseases outbreak, whether it's a 1998 like Nipah virus leading to 1.1 million pigs being slaughtered, or like in the most recent year, African swine fever in Philippines, having 250,000 pigs just killed for nothing. The public, I don't think, really get a lot of information on that. We were surprised that there isn't a public like database monitoring platform for all these zoonotic disease outbreak. So I don't think this is a topmost thing to be interested in. But given that these have a huge effect, not just on animals' health and welfare issues, but also on people working on these farms and society and food supplies, it's interesting that we cannot easily find when the outbreaks are happening. Yeah. So, yeah, both Lefteris and I were just, the first thing we separately did was to Google and try to find it. We realized that, we actually have to dig information. He actually went into trying to look into media reports and different reports to find it. So yeah, that's something that came up for us.
Nice. I think that's a really interesting, almost like campaigning tool, or like for public advocacy, which is something like, here's how many zoonotic diseases have been caused by intensive animal farming. And then when you see a big spreadsheet of them and you see how many animals died and how many maybe people were affected, it's like, oh God, maybe, you know, meat isn't so safe. Maybe it's not so healthy for humans. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a quite interesting thing that maybe no one has really leveraged. So yeah, that's a cool database.
Yeah, you're right, James. People have died as well. So it wasn't just animals being cows. And it's something that we just seem to assume that, after one outbreak, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Just keep producing. But not much public information is easily found. Yeah.
I'm interested to know, what are some common misconceptions about animal advocacy, and if you've come across any, and maybe it also links into the report that perhaps there's some findings that people in the global movement aren't aware of in the Southeast Asia region. Do you feel like there are any misconceptions that kind of stand out to you that we could learn from?
Misconceptions. It's hard to know because, to be frank, I just don't think I've gotten enough sense of the global movement yet. We're very like deep into program development, our team at DV and I. So we get our sense of the movement through like emails from FUS and, from Ava. One thing I would say, maybe Asia is not all the same. It's a huge continent. Even Southeast Asia as a subcontinent is very varied. So there's no one way to understand what's the animal agriculture landscape or the consumption patterns or strategies that can be applied. It's really, really hard to bring in any particular types of approach, as you say, Amy, just now, to apply to this region. I wish that it's so easy that we can just copy what's worked with corporate campaigns and in the EU when it comes to EU-wide and the KHH campaigns to this region. For any KHH over here in our report, we're like, animal sentience are not really recognized. So there's some, it's not entirely bad because I think society recognizes not to treat animal cruelly. It's just whether there's enough bandwidth for applying that. I think we need to remember that this is a region where there are still a lot of human issues to like extreme poverty existing. So I think those who are in power just have a lot to juggle. And so it's for animal advocates to bring this issue to the forefront and try to work on it. And on corporate campaigns, I think you also pointed out just now, Amy, that I've heard this from another organization that only a percentage of eggs being sold in the market, I believe in Malaysia, it's just in a formal supply chain, meaning it's being sold from producers to supermarkets. The rest are actually, I think majority are actually dispersed in different ways. You don't really know how to pinpoint where the source of the eggs are from. You can't really pinpoint where it is passed down the chain to the consumer side. With regards to that, then corporate campaigns won't have as far-reaching of an effect as, say, when you do that in the US. I don't think it's not helpful at all. I think it's still very needed because, as you can see, in Thailand, there's such a huge amount of animal production and products production. So that can still be quite an effect if corporate campaigns actually work out. But it won't be solving welfare issues all at once. So Asia is not one place all the same. It's the main misconception I would highlight.
Yeah, it's so valid, Wanyi. I always feel like that when, we're referring and even, you know, within this podcast, just saying Southeast Asia and not individual countries and trying to kind of get a sense of bunching that together. And it was similar on the episode that we had with Aurelia, we're talking about Africa. But of course, you know, within that, multiple countries, all different challenges, different landscapes, different ways of farming their animals. And we really need to get down to that granular country level to understand the advocacy better. Do you think that there are kind of advantages in the identification of that kind of smaller region to work within? So kind of maybe from a funding angle, or do you see any kind of positives of it being kind of a Southeast Asia movement versus individual countries, as well as the challenges?
Definitely for advantages. I think our fellowship wouldn't have existed if we didn't group this as a Southeast Asian fellowship.
Right.
Having like people who feel connected to a particular region, feel like they're part of a community, it's not just within your own country that working on. We know that people feel a sense that I'm not alone. It's not just things are hard in the country I'm based in, but we are all in it together and we're trying to make some progress. So there are advantages. Funding-wise, I think, I don't know for sure, but I think, as I mentioned just now, that what I've heard in the earlier, like just a few years ago, is that funders have seen this as there's a lot of things happening in this region, not a lot of work is happening. Maybe to that extent of just trying to have some way of categorizing things at a regional level, it's still helpful to talk about. So conditions, socioeconomic status of countries, still somewhat useful to categorize. But when it comes to interventions, that's the part that we need to be very nuanced about.
Maybe to come back to generalizations and misconceptions. One I have of Southeast Asia, and I think maybe we touched on this, is it seems like maybe obviously the scope of the problem is huge, and like one of the bottlenecks to making good work is just finding people who are dedicated to animal advocacy and want to start and projects and do jobs in the space. Is that broadly right? It's just like we need to find more awesome advocates to kind of go out and do stuff. Is that broadly right, or you think there's some nuance there as well?
There will be new ones there, because I think when I see like the advocates in places where the movement is more mature, like in North America or in Europe, UK, I think that I find people are very much already into being a vegan. seeing animal welfare issues in a certain light. When we do our fellowship, we realize that there's a continuum of people who care about farmed animals. We actually have very few vegans in our fellowship. We were surprised, and we were grappling with, should we actually only accept people who have a particular diet choices that to accept? No, we wouldn't be able to find anyone to work in the space if we actually make that. So that's something I think.
So interesting.
Don't assume that you come to a conference in Asia and everyone's going to be vegan. But do people care about farmed animals? Yes. There are people in our fellowship who actually works in the producing side, whom we were quite reluctant to whether accept in, because after graduation, they will be entering a company to actually be producing farmed animals. We were like, what change can that do for farmed animals? But the sincerity of people to want to learn and say that they think that pigs can feel pain. They think that pigs should not be going through the lives that they are living when they're being farmed, got us to just use the criteria very differently for accepting people. We also have people who are like very much more rights oriented. So what we needed to do in the fellowship was to make sure that we create a safe space for people who actually have very different approaches to how they lead their lives. To be able to come together for the issue. So we don't actually, I think the way we do the movement building here is a little different. We do worry, when I say we, like Divya and I do discuss a lot, and worry about to what level are we compromising the, are we going to bring in people who do not understand the issues into the movement well enough, the so-called value alignment. That's why we designed the fellowship in such a way that it's as much as possible, it's not forcing an idea on people, but to give people the information that they need for why are certain animals prioritized, what interventions seem to be useful for you to consider. That's kind of how we have been seeing like the advocates that are joining the movement. Did I actually answer your question, James?
Yeah, the question was about like, is there a bottleneck of finding good, talented people? And I guess from your answer, I'm gleaning still a bit yes, because even what you're saying about the number of people who want to do the fellowship aren't necessarily, you know, eating a vegan diet, which kind of shows the movement may still be quite nascent in terms of the values that maybe we think are quite pervasive in the kind of like Western animal rights, animal advocacy scene isn't quite yet embedded. So I think that makes me think, yes. And also your point where if you made that requirement, you'd have a very small pool of people and maybe not the best people either. So I think that seems very reasonable that you do kind of try to keep a broad tent in terms of finding people. Because I think like the producer person, I mean, if there's someone who works in a production company, yes, maybe it doesn't seem ideal, but you also need people on the inside and then they can influence people. There's great connections to be had. So I think that can actually be quite a valuable resource to have.
Yeah,
100%. I think it's such a pragmatic approach. And actually, you know, you talked about it being a safe space. And I think that's really interesting language when we think about the movement in the West, because actually I think we're so dogmatic about what vegan means and how you need to perform as that vegan that actually I think we miss out on a lot of pragmatic opportunities to make change. Say there was an opportunity in the UK to train a ton of people who aren't vegan, but, you know, work in the movement and are going to go and be producers or like young farmers. And we're teaching them how to, you know, better instill this sense of better welfare for the animals in their system. So I think it's kind of an interesting, like as a tactic, I think it's definitely interesting and something that I think we actually miss out on in the more sort of developed movement, because I think we get a little closed off and a little tunnel vision that if it's not vegan, it's not worthwhile.
We also have been very slow in bringing people in. Each fellowship takes quite a while. So far, as long as we cast the net wide in credit goes to Divya for doing the marketing of the fellowship, we seem to be able to find enough applicants and then narrow down to a pool of 20-ish people to accept into the fellowship. So, I remember that in the very early days, I was speaking to someone who is a funder in the movement on whether we should do a fellowship and whether we can potentially find people. I was just thinking like, well, the population in Southeast Asia is around 600 million. Maybe it's climbing very fast. Out of 600 million people, can we find at least 100 people caring about animals? I suppose we probably can, because we're not like a region where there aren't animal people. There are people who are like pet owners and the animal lovers in different ways. So I suppose it's more like us needing to figure out what types of people would get interested. And we've heard from some people who joined our fellowship that they felt quite lonely, not knowing that other people actually care. And they finally found like a community of people whom they can go back to. So I suppose it's more of trying to figure out some better ways to find the people who care. And on the vegan part, this is completely anecdotal. We've heard from fellows who, because we do insert one or two sessions on plant-based movement for awareness and a balanced view of the issues. We've heard people are changing their diets just from whether it's fully or not. It's really heartening because the culture here just is pretty different. So we just think that not making it, as Amy said, being pragmatic is something we're trying to do. We don't want it to be too dogmatic. We want things to make progress. And so it just seems that once you are part of the movement, you're part of a program, you get some sense of what kind of things you can do more of, not just professionally, career-wise interventions, but small things like we can do in our lives. So making the space welcoming can also, get more people to reduce animal consumption.
And yeah, so I think we've kind of skirted around the topic a bit, but so in terms of the fellowship, what actually is the fellowship? What does it look like? You said you take roughly 20 people per cohort, but what actually happens and what's the kind of curriculum or the format of this?
Yeah, I just segued into the program part.
Perfect.
Great. So our fellowship's name is called the Southeast Asia Farm and Welfare Fellowship. We were not original. We copied the International Farm and Welfare Fellowship in the title. And our fellowship, which I would call it CFOF for ease of referring for the rest of the podcast, is a 14-week program. Each week we have an hour and a half of session. People who join are generally people who are interested and has a potential to have a career in farmed animal advocacy in this region. They have to be local. They have to be based here. And they need to be people who have some level of awareness about farmed animal welfare rights issues. Not a ton. If a ton, then our fellowship would not be useful. But the way people talk about why they care about farmed animals, what do they think farmed animals actually need, gets them accepted. Our goal is it's a talent pipeline program. We are trying to get people who would not be involved in a movement to be involved in a movement. And so we don't really, as we said earlier, we don't really target people who necessarily are vegans, because they might already be contributing in many different ways. We're trying to cast the net wider to attract people who would be interested to contribute. They also have to be open-minded so to join the fellowship. So we do a ton of interviews before accepting someone in to get a sense that they will be able to feel open to the information being shared with them. The fellowship is divided into a few parts. First, it's just to have a general like overview of the issues. We try to make it as Southeast Asia contextualized as possible. It's not always possible because of the little information that we have. And then we try to share what the interventions that have worked so far in the West to share with people the effective strategies that have been happening. And the last part of the fellowship gets them to consider a few skills, research skills and effective communication skills, and trying to help them think about doing a project proposal. So the project proposal is an exercise that's non-binding. They don't have to implement it, but we wanted that there to be an exercise to get people to reflect on what they have learned and try and imagine what they can try to do. So it's not necessarily high quality, high impact ideas, but it really helps the fellows to do an end of fellowship reflection. So far, everything is online. We don't always have a fixed plan for bringing people together. We're just leveraging other existing events that happen. And so recently we see the Asia Farm Animal Day conference happening. We were able to have our fellows there. We try to have an element of when can we have in-person FaceTime with people, but the entire fellowship is online. And when I say talent pipeline, it's really trying to help the movement find more people who would be suited to work on farmed animal advocacy in the countries that we're looking at in Southeast Asia.
Nice. In terms of the final project, or the project at the end, what kind of stuff does that usually form it? Is it like ideas to do like a new intervention or maybe a new organization, or what's the kind of output tend to look like?
It's not very groundbreaking, and a part of it is because we don't have a lot of time for the fellows. They need to learn everything in the first like 10 weeks and then try to put something together. And these are people who have full-time jobs. We don't have any stipends to encourage them. It's out of their own internal motivation to join. So the commitment is really high. The projects that we see, in the end, we have a symposium for them to do a lightning showcase to an audience. Some of the things that we see are what they learned, like trying to get a particular supermarket chain to go cage-free, or to get a more plant-based movement going within a particular space. Or some people are thinking of having a podcast in a local language to promote the ideas of farming welfare and food technology. I would say these are more like practice exercises to warm up, and not really where the fellow's potential would be with the ideas.
And so is the idea that they join existing organizations or maybe look for funding for themselves to fund a specific project?
The idea is for them to join an organization to be hired, but we don't have enough organizations in Southeast Asia.
How's that gone so far from the previous round? So how many rounds have you done so far?
Only two, actually.
So, cool. Exciting. That's cool. And is it like every 6 months or every year? What's the kind of cadence you're doing them?
We wanted to have a timeline. To be honest, it hasn't worked out based on our timeline. We were so ambitious at the start because we realized that we are not just importing something that exists and just applying it. We take actually 5 months to design and then put out the applications, interview people and accept. So we've done two rounds so far. One is the English round that was targeting people from six countries in the region. Obviously, English as in the medium, the language being used is English language. So the criteria for the first round require people to need to have a level of competency in English. And the second round we just finished was in Vietnamese. We have this idea of trying to run a fellowship in a local language based out of what we had designed in the first round to reduce English as a barrier to access the movement. And we were surprised, because this is quite experimental, whether it would work. We were surprised that we actually got quite a lot of applications, similar to the numbers in the first round, and that people actually were very engaged to overcome the language barrier. Although quite a lot of our speakers are still English speaking, we do have live interpreters for our sessions, and we have a country manager who's outreach for the team to the fellows when it comes to communications in Vietnamese. So interest level has been there. the first round had 26 out of 31 who joined complete. Completion is like at least 9 sessions out of the 14 sessions. So our attrition rate's pretty low. And for the second round, we had 23 out of 25 who completed. Jobs-wise, we only have data for the first round because the recent round just completed. We have about 38% of all the fellows from the first round have been working full-time.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, but some of them already are working in the space. So at least 3 out of the 16 that we're looking at were already working in the movement. We felt they were overqualified to join the program and didn't want them in.
It's a nice thing to hear if you apply. You're like, oh no, you're too qualified. Please don't join.
Yeah, because they've been doing the work before I started, before Divya and I started being involved. And we were, but they were so humbled by people who have been working for so long on farmed animal advocacy, longer than us, wanting to join. And we found out after the whole fellowship that they felt that this is a more structured way for them to understand the issues. And they actually have still learned stuff because they joined alone. Some of them joined, one of them mentioned to us that they joined the world because they've cared about animals for so long. The organization that this person had been in was already part of the Open Wing Alliance. So they had trainings and the fellowship shared why some animals are prioritized, the scale of it. And it's very interesting to hear the feedback that now I know why I'm prioritizing layer hens welfare out of all the animals. So it's very interesting to see that this fellowship can still be of some help to some people. But yeah, we are not trying to look at people who are already working in the space. To the wild part of how many people have been working after our fellowship, I also want to point out the luck factor. Because
you're being humble, I
think. No, I'm setting expectations for our future fellowships. Because jobs opened up for that period of time that we finished the fellowship. And then we also had a retreat for the region's farmed animal advocates and people were meeting. And so it was a combination of factors that we can't always fully design. And people met in person, they chatted, they realized that I probably would want this person to work with me, or, you know, that the jobs opened up and the fellows applied, or another fellow mentioned to one of the fellows that, hey, my organization is opening up a position. Would you want to try applying? So there was such a great experience that all these factors were in place and people were able to find jobs. We're so heartened to see some of the fellows are doing things that I don't know any knowledge about. I was on a farm visit in Yogyakarta this year and seeing one of our fellows working with the organization and being the translator for producers, being in action, I was like, wow, these are things that we cannot do and we can see people doing. We're super heartened by that. And so while we want to continue to replicate and be able to have more people work in the space, we're a little conscious that whether we are actually hitting a plateau with the number of job opportunities that are opening up by organizations in this region.
And then have you got any big plans to fix that?
We're not trying to fix it per se, but we are very lucky to get an opportunity to have some funding to run an incubation program through Welfare Matters. It would take quite a bit of time for us to nail down the specifics. Our general proposal when we put in the funding application was to seed a few projects in this region, specifically for farm animal welfare interventions. We have this general idea of trying to look at charity entrepreneurship's model and also trying to look at what are some of the specific interventions in this region that might be able to find entrepreneurial types of people to apply and join the incubation program. Initially, when we ran the fellowship program, we thought that some of the fellows who graduated could potentially go to charity entrepreneurship's program. But the bar is so high for church entrepreneurship. So it's amazing that you moved through it. I don't think I would even qualify to apply for church entrepreneurship.
It was easier before. It's gotten harder now. It used to be everyone could get in.
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. A couple of things that we learned after the first round, why people might not be suited after the fellowship to go for CE, is that we made a call in the fellowship. We promoted it in a way for working in the space. So we found that people are more suited to work in organizations for the people who came out of our fellowship. And so the incubation program, we're trying to attract people who are more self-starters and who like to the challenge of starting an organization or a project on their own. So we think that that would also attract people who care about farm to animal issues, but maybe a different type of personality and crowd. That's our hope for the incubation program so far. Launch it next year, try to seed X number of projects, maybe 10 or less.
10's a lot. If you could start 10, that would be it. That would be an incredible achievement.
That's why we're not going to commit to that number. We are doing a lot of, we're going to do a lot of research in this next 2 months to talk to people about what's the hits and misses. So shout out to anyone who can give us tips. We would love to speak to you on how you think we can run our program well. And so the minimum is each project will get at least 20,000 USD for a startup funding. The seed fund. But everything is up in the air. Next year when the program launch, it could be completely different. So please keep an open mind and not hold me to any of this thing I'm announcing.
That's great. So people, I'm assuming you'll find out on most of the channels that we have about any more information, and people could refer to your website next year for more information on that.
Definitely, yeah. And we are just trying to, we're viewing it in this way because we know that regranting has happened in Southeast Asia. From our knowledge, regranting has been happening to existing organizations so far. So we are super lucky to be able to try out finding individuals who can start new interventions in this region. And we want people who are very local. So some of the challenges is we don't know whether language will be a barrier. It's mostly going to be conducted in English, but I've tried to ask if, say, E-Animal Welfare Fund has applications that are non-English. And I believe there hasn't been such applications before. So we are also not sure if we find someone who's very promising, but is not very fluent in English, whether what it would look like. So we have tons of things to discover. Most importantly, we just want something to, we want more opportunities to be seated in this region to see more welfare interventions happening. Yeah, that's the top level thing for the incubation program.
It's great, Wanyi. I'm so pleased you exist. I think despite your humbleness, when referring to your own success, I was invited to see the graduation ceremony of the Vietnamese fellowship round just now, and I think just seeing their, how grateful they were to have this opportunity to join the fellowship, to learn what they've learned, I think you know that the people are there, they want to learn, they want to grow, they want to work in the movement. And I think seeing that come to fruition just showed how much work you and Divya and the team have put into this region, considering things like, you know, the dominance of the English language in this movement and trying to make it more accessible. All of this, in my opinion, is just so necessary, so needed for the progression of the movement in this region. So, yeah, just thank you for the work that you do in the team, and best of luck with the future fellowship rounds.
Thanks, Amy. Well, we invited you so that you would say this on the podcast. No,
I was paid.
No, it's incredibly smart marketing. I did not see that coming. I'm joking.
Amy was our speaker in the first round. We invited past speakers because speakers don't actually get the benefit of interacting with our fellows. It's great that you can be there in Asia, Amy. It's really a joke.
It's great.
That's very cool. I mean, yeah, overall about the incubation program, I'm also very excited about it because I think it just feels like we just need so many more shots on goal, so to speak. Like you said, it's huge region, very diverse, lots of animals, and a relatively small number of projects trying to tackle a very huge issue. So I think the more different kinds of approaches or people or ideas we can get working on it, I think the better. And I think, yeah, I think charity entrepreneurship has done pretty amazing work and being able to create kind of scalable, good interventions. And it's okay if some fail, because that's life. But I think even if a few of them work, I think that's still incredibly worthwhile. So yeah, I'm very excited to see the results as well.
Thank you. We'll work hard on it.
No pressure. And so you think it'll be like next summer, roughly, when you'll run the program? And
yeah,
like, it'll be like a similar, I guess you don't have any ideas on the program, but like an 8-week kind of style?
Yeah. Carolina, cool, from Charity Entrepreneurship has been super helpful to us. We actually chatted about it since last year, around this time when we first mentioned to her, we have this idea, and she's super helpful in sharing with us how CE has run things and some tips. And we're just trying to learn. I've got the book somewhere here. Have not finished the entire book.
It's a good book. It's a good
book. It is a good book. I'm grateful to Eva for distributing that to everyone. So we're still doing a lot of research, and one thing we're unsure is if we would do a very top-down approach like CE does, because we're still in this process of figuring things out. By that, I mean, CE seems to have a list of research ideas already out there, potentially high-impact ones they want to see happen. Honestly, we're still trying to figure out how much of it we would do it this way and or not. So we have a ton of figuring out for how the incubation program will look like.
Very exciting.
Let's move on to the closing then. This has been very interesting and really insightful in terms of how we in the sort of global movement can support the work in Southeast Asia and what we know we need to do to have progress in the region. So thanks, Wanyi, for going into detail in those areas. Do you have any hopeful news that you have been excited about recently? Perhaps something from the recent conference or something that's just really excited you about the movement right now?
Yeah, I think for the movement, I am so excited that Asia Farm Animal Day exists, and I'm completely biased, but I am so excited that Eva and EFE have collaborated on this, and excited to hear the news that next year it'll be happening again and in Vietnam. So hoping to see the growth in the number of attendees. I think that would be a sign of the development of the movement in this region. Some of the news would be, I read on the Singapore news earlier this month that cultivated pork would be hitting Singapore's market next year. So it's not pausing. It is happening. So yeah, it's not just cultivated chicken that exists. Seems that other types of cultivated meat will be coming in. Although I must say, I have not tried it.
Peter Singer has.
He's come to Singapore, quietly to try it. People found out after he left. But yeah, it's actually, I think supply is still an issue. So to set everyone's expectation, I think you have to be really making your reservations very early or in order to try it. That's the good news, that it's out there. People are trying it, and the scaling up of the production will probably be happening in the next few years. So very excited about that, changing the food production landscape.
And we'll link to those conferences in the show notes. So it's the Animal and Vegan Advocacy Summit, also known as AVA, and Asia for Animals, that combined for the most recent Asia Farmed Animal Day in Kuala Lumpur. All the animals, all the farms, all the days. So yes, lots of acronyms, but we will link all of the details below.
Do you have any media recommendations? So it could be books, podcasts, movies, anything in terms of stuff to recommend either on your worldview or on knowing more about the Asian farmed animal landscape?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I'm gonna make a plug for another podcast if you don't mind me. There's a
How dare you? Outrageous.
but yours is still better.
Okay, it's fine. You can keep going.
So Curious Vedant is a podcast that is run by this 10-year-old whose mom and dad are in the movement for you to both for listeners to discover. And Curious Vedant has been interviewing a lot of folks in Asia, not just farmed animal folks or opera team folks, but his uncles and aunties from all over the world. But you can pick some of the farmed animal advocates. You can see them from his podcast. And he's asking from, I know people start young these days. So he started when he was 7 or 8, been like, I don't know how many seasons. So you might be interested to check out. He's interviewed so many people as well. Curious Vedant, plug over there. Other things, I think that in this region, APAC, Nikhil Kla has a newsletter series. I don't think this goes out in a on a very regular monthly basis, but this is somebody who invests in the odd protein space and has very interesting insights and also having quite a bit of an APAC view. I suppose if people are interested in Asia, I would say maybe to check out books that are written by Lee Kuan Yew, who is actually the founding prime minister of Singapore. He actually has a lot of interesting insights on Asia, but this is very like on the side of politics. And so not directly relevant. One of the books, the last book that he had before he passed away was One Man's View of the World. I can share the link. I don't think we would agree with everything. But it could be interesting for people who wants to understand a very pragmatic view about Asia and Asia's connection to North America and Europe.
Great.
Nice. Very interesting.
Sounds good. Thank you.
I would think people would know this book as well, but I also really like Grilled by Leah Gassis because
Grilled, yeah, good book.
I think Grilled helps us keep in mind the people who are farming, their perspective, their life circumstances. Of course, in US it's different from Southeast Asia's context. But I really appreciate that book for the perspective that it offers advocates.
Perfect. And so there's the launch next year of the program. People can check in on the website around that time for more information. You have your report, the state of animal farming in Southeast Asia, that people could access again, that we'll both link. Is there any other ways that people can get involved in your work? I'm assuming donations are always welcome. Do you have any volunteer opportunities or any other ways in which people can get involved?
Yeah, we do have a Welfare Matters newsletter. So that's one way you can keep in touch with what's coming up. It's monthly. DVL works with our colleague who is also Amy. We actually are pausing on accepting donations for now, but we do have some research that we think has some funding gap. So that one would be where we would be interested to know more. But in general, I think our programs, we're doing okay with funding for now. Hiring, we actually would like to hire someone as a program associate, ideally based out of Singapore, because we do appreciate the face time when we have for the regions program. And we will be hiring for a position in Indonesia in order to help us launch the next round of our fellowship, which will be in Bahasa Indonesia. The Welfare Matters newsletter is the best place to get updated on what's happening.
Great. We will definitely link that. And so Divi will be happy with your booming subscribers, I hope. We'll see.
Yeah, credit goes to her and Amy.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Wanyi. This has been a super interesting conversation, and it's been so nice to cover such a wide range of topics and a very important topic. So I guess thanks for your time and all your amazing work, and looking forward to seeing much more.
Thanks so much, James and Amy.
Thanks, Wanyi.
Really pleasure to be here.